on air, WICC 600, online, WICC600.com. Let's stimulate your brain with the Lisa Wexler Show.
Well, I'm in heaven now. Maybe Andrew Yin, our next guest, believes there's a heaven. Maybe she's seen it. Maybe she doesn't believe it. But for whatever it is, this is the reason I'm doing this radio. I'm able to talk to people like Andrew Yin. Andrew Yin is the executive producer and writer of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. She's won a ton of awards, Peabody's, Emmys, every kind of award you can think of. She is the widow of Carl Sagan, with whom she had two children, and they had a stepchild. She also has a stepson, and he died back, unfortunately, in 1996. Cosmos was a transformative event, not only in PBS history, but in American cultural scientific knowledge and awareness. And the book sold 40 million copies. The television show was watched by umpteen people. And I think it's fair to say that Anne, along with Carl, basically destigmatized and de-scientificized, if I could use that word, the complicated nature of astronomy, bringing it right down to average regular people and making us enthralled. Andrew Yin, I'm so beyond over the moon, so to speak, happy to welcome you to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Lisa. What a lavish introduction. So generous. I'm really thrilled to be with you too.
Well, I am also, my other life, I host something called the Accorda Scientific Excellence Award, Anne, and we've been going on for 7 years. And on Saturday mornings, I play these radio broadcasts. We're on a temporary hiatus, but I play these radio broadcasts of a half-hour interview with these brilliant young scientific students in the area, and we've got this panel of scientists that chooses winners. And I'm the layperson on the panel. So for 7 years, every week, I've been immersed in these extraordinary projects. It's the only thing that gives me hope for the future. It's what you do, but it's the only thing that gives me hope for the future.
Lisa, I am so right with you because I am not a scientist. I am the average, ordinary person who longed to understand the majesty and beauty of nature as revealed by science. And I was so lucky to get into a situation where I could spend my life telling these stories, knowing that if I didn't understand them and if they didn't move me in my soul, I wasn't doing my job. So thank you for doing that excellent work of encouraging young scientists. That's so important.
And I was reading about the fact that you were the creative director of NASA's Voyager Interstellar Message Project, and that you worked with a team to create a message for possible alien civilizations. You have to tell us about that.
Well, that was a complete dream, a mythic and epic project. Very lucky. In 1976, I'd been working with Carl on another project, and we had the experience of thinking together. And when this opportunity to put two golden disks on each of the Voyager spacecraft, that would not only be the first spacecraft to do the epic reconnaissance of the outer solar system, but then by virtue of a gravitational assist from mighty Jupiter, they would be flung out into the galaxy with a shelf life of 5 billion years, roaming the galaxy, making perhaps a dozen circumnavigations of the galaxy before they deteriorated to such an extent that they couldn't be decrypted. And it was my joy to be part of using the music, the images, the sounds of Earth, the greetings in 59 human languages and one whale language, the humpback. Oh. And so, you know, it was a dream, not only in the sense of creating a Noah's Ark of human culture that would last 5 billion years, but also it coincided with my discovery and Carl's that we were meant to be together. So it's very dear to my heart, that wonderful project.
We're chatting with Andrew Yin. So, Anne, you possibly, of all the different musical sounds created by human beings on Earth, what did you ultimately choose and why to be on that record that would last 5 billion years? What did you choose? Bach and Beethoven? What did you do? Tell me.
Yes, we did choose Bach and Beethoven, but we also chose Peruvian panpipes, a Mexican popular song, Japanese shakuhachi music, a magnificent ancient piece, a Chinese piece performed on the qin by the great virtuoso of that instrument. We also had Senegalese percussion. We really felt, and I'm not even, you know, there were 27 pieces. We really believed that in order to send a message about Earth, we had to educate ourselves about the world's great musical traditions. And by so doing, many people credit the Voyager record with the beginning of world music, of seeing the music of other cultures with equal respect and enjoyment as those that we are familiar with. So it was, you know, there were about half a dozen people involved, but we consulted musicians, ethnomusicologists, composers, everyone we could in that very brief 6 month period, because we wanted it to, you know, we knew that it was going to outlast, in fact, the future of the Earth as it is now. And so we really had to get it right.
That's unbelievable. We're chatting with Andrew Yin, who was married to Carl Sagan for many years and who alongside him brought to us some of the most amazing, I would say, scientific programming that enabled us to enjoy and wonder at our universe without being so intimidated by it, which is the point, right? Because so many of us are intimidated by the word science, not to mention the mathematical equations that go beyond it, that it makes a lot of us tune out. And I was interested in, because I was reading in Wikipedia that you grew up in Queens. I'm a Brooklyn girl, but I grew up on Long Island in Woodmere, so right next door to where you grew up.
Right, and, I know Woodmere.
Right there. And my first job was at JFK, like right there. And anyway.
Right, that's right near where I grew up.
Right near where you. Did you grow up, where did you grow up? Forest Hills, Howard Beach, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Fresh Meadows.
Fresh Meadows, of course.
I'm a proud graduate of Jamaica High School, which was a wonderful place. And Carl, of course, was just like you, from Brooklyn, when Brooklyn wasn't the place to be. And
right, it was not. It was the place to get out of. It was the place to get out of. My parents couldn't wait to leave. I know.
Exactly. But, you know, we both owed a tremendous debt to the excellent public school teachers who educated us, along with our parents, who were so conscientious in exposing us. You know, they were lower middle class people. You know, they didn't have a lot, but they really exposed us to great literature and values that I cherish to this day.
Yeah, we're chatting with Andrew. And so, there are so many questions I want to ask you. I want to ask you this. Let me just go back to Voyager for a little bit, because pardon my ignorance, but do we still get any messages from Voyager 1 or 2, or are they, we do?
Both of them. We hear from them. We communicate with both spacecraft every single week. I get a bulletin every week. And think of the achievement. This is mid, early 70s technology. I mean, we're talking about transistors. We're talking about, you know, your phone has infinitely more computing power than the Voyagers had. And yet they were designed so brilliantly that 43 years later, they have been moving at 35,000 miles for virtually all of that time, 35,000 miles an hour. And they still check in. We check in with them. In fact, a year or two ago, we had to start up one of the thrusters to slightly change the angle of the trajectory. And it was as if you left your car in the garage for more than 40 years. And for the first time, you just put the key in the ignition and started it up, and it roared And that's what the Voyager spacecraft did. They're the furthest objects ever touched by human hands with a 5 billion year long future.
And what are they telling us, Anne? What are they telling us?
Well, they told us. I mean, this is what's so amazing. First of all, they completed the reconnaissance of the outer solar system, which in itself would have been enough. But then, of course, they're both going in different directions. And when they left that place where the wind from the sun dies down and what we call the interstellar medium begins, they showed us for the very first time the shape of our solar system as it moves through the galaxy. You know, we have learned so much. They discovered moons, volcanoes in the solar system, so many things. They answered so many questions. And, you know, it's to me, it's one of the high points of human achievement, just the, not my part of it, but the spacecraft itself. Mm-hmm. Because of what it's given us and how it never hurt a single person. That's the kind of science and high technology that I love.
You know, as a scientist, as somebody who literally looks at the big picture all the time, I just wonder, I would, it's such a vast thing, but I wonder how you must feel personally about how we are, as human beings, how are we treating planet Earth in terms of,
It's an oi, right?
In terms of its ability to sustain all this life, right? I mean, it's just, Lisa, it's like you look up and then you look down, right? Yeah.
I mean, I just have to say one thing. I'm not a scientist. I'm someone who had an amazing 20-year tutorial with the greatest teacher, I think, of the modern age, Carl Sagan. But I'm not a scientist. I am just like you. I was bored and intimidated by my science classes and felt completely incompetent. And
me too.
And it was only I left school and I began to discover the power of science on my own. And then, of course, to get to know Carl. And to so I have vast areas of ignorance, but I have learned a thing or two in the last 43 years. And I look at what we're doing to the planet in abject horror. I look at our current leadership in panic, really, because of how disdainful they are of science, how disdainful they are of just, you know, truth. Nature will not be deceived. We are tearing at the fabric of life on this planet so violently, so horribly. And I hope my book, Cosmos Possible Worlds, leaves the reader with a sense of hope, because it's a story of so many people you've never heard of who, over the ages, you know, really had their backs to the wall, but managed to stand up. And we can stand up. It's not too late now. But if we fail now to do what we have to do, we are dooming the children and grandchildren we claim to love to a world so much less hospitable and so much harder to live in than even the one we have now. It's not too late. Science has redemptive powers. It can heal. If used with foresight and wisdom, it can heal this planet. And we can have that great future that I imagine in the book. But we really have to get our act together right this minute and stand up and change course.
Andrew, in the book is Cosmos Possible Worlds, published by National Geographic. It is extraordinarily beautiful. We didn't even get into some of the people you talk about, Vavilov and others of these marvelous scientists. I'm told you have to move on to the next, you know, meeting or interview that you're scheduled with. I would love, Anne, please, may I welcome you back on the show to extend this conversation and really get into the nitty-gritty of your book and these various scientists? I feel like we've only scratched the surface. Would you come back on the show?
Anytime, anytime you say, I'll be a regular if you let me, I tell you. I really enjoyed our conversation. I'm sorry I have to run, but you have been more than wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Andrewian, on the Lisa Wexler Show this morning. Get the book, Cosmos, Possible Worlds. We'll be right back.